You're listening to Irish Radio Canada's Home and Abroad, and I'm delighted to be sitting down with Robert Kearns. Robert, who has had a most powerful influence on the Irish community, not just in Toronto, but in Canada, and he is the founder of the Canada Ireland Foundation, which created Ireland Park and Grasset Park in Toronto, and now is in the midst of, and close to the finalisation, I think, of the Corlec, a new arts and cultural heritage hub. And it is set to open on the waterfront in 2026. And when I look at Robert's life and career, he has been involved in altruistic efforts for the Irish community and helping the Irish community, God knows how long, to the extent that his service to the Irish community in 2016 was rewarded with the Irish Presidential Distinguished Service Award. And he was also honoured in 2021 with the Governor General's Ontario Heritage Award for Lifetime Achievement. He's been a member of numerous boards and founded and participated in numerous organisations. Robert, thank you so much for taking the time and delighted to have you here and to get to
well,
chat with you.
Thank you. Awesome.
Robert, from an early stage, there was something in you that wanted to give back. And the reason you and I are having this conversation at the moment is you're passing the torch of the Canada Ireland Foundation onto Mark Purdy, and we'll be chatting with Mark later on. But from early on, there was something inside of you that said there's more important things in life than just amassing things around me, that I need to be a part of community.
Well, thank you for that observation, Austin. It's probably quite accurate. I'm the son of the youngest of four boys. My father was in the Irish Department of Social Welfare. So at the lunch and dinner table, I heard of his work in helping somebody get a pension or a disability benefit or getting unemployment insurance. And all these sort of stories I heard from his days working in the Department of Social Welfare. He ran the unemployment exchange in Gardner Street. So he dealt with a lot of, pretty colourful characters and told some fantastic stories, which I won't burden you with now. But it was a household, a civil service household, where my dad was always helping people. So when I came to Canada in November 79, my first job the day or so after I arrived was working as a barman in what's now Tyrone's on Adelaide Street. And in January, I met a guy from from Rap Mines, who was in the insurance business. And over the course of that month, January and February, which is 45 years ago now, he recruited me into the business and into the life insurance business. And that was about, listening to people's problems and, offering solutions. And it did suit my temperament and my disposition that it was a rewarding experience to help others. Now, I also studied archaeology and Greek and Roman civilization and history at University College Dublin. I had a very happy childhood in Ireland, with the exception of my time at secondary schools run by the Holy Ghost Fathers or the Spiritans. We're not going to talk about that today. And I just thought that I always had this feeling that Canada had this very rich, deep Irish history that really wasn't explored fully. The dynamic of the Crown in Canada and, the Irish government's approach to Canada was very different from that of the United States. And the degree of success in Canada was measured by how swiftly you could chameleon-like blend into the Canadian landscape. It wasn't, especially in the 70s and 80s, at the peak of the Troubles in Ireland, that one was celebrating one's Irish nationality. That came later. So that being said, I first got involved with Irish community events and activities in May 1980, when I was invited to join the Volunteer Committee of the Ireland Fund of Canada, as Hilary Weston was passing the torch to Jerry Sweeney. And that coincided very closely with the beginnings shortly thereafter of the hunger strikes. And so peace, culture, and charity, which was the motto of the Ireland Fund at the time, was not an easy concept to sell, even though it was all very laudable. But Canadians were suspicious of anything involving fundraising for matters Irish. But I believed it was important to persevere. And so we had, I was involved in the first black tie dinner in Toronto for the Ireland Fund in 1982. And then also I chaired the first lunch as chair of the volunteer committee in 83. And there were 75 people at it. And James Galway was the guest of honor. And he performed in the newly opened Roy Thompson Hall the night before. And he, unfortunately, he arrived with the 16 members of his orchestra. So the event lost money. So the second year's event was held to make up the losses of the first. But, that was really the beginning of my journey. And I really enjoyed it because I thought, okay, well, I live in Canada now. I really felt very much at home here and very happy to be here. And at the same time, I had warm feelings about Ireland, and obviously I couldn't pursue Irish archaeology here, but I continued to read and keep abreast of what was going on in Irish archaeology, and I always enjoyed reading about the Greek and Roman world, and obviously I followed history, especially military history, both of Canada and in the First and Second World War, which is quite extraordinary. So as time went by, then I became vice chair of the Ireland Fund in 87 and then chair in 89. I stepped down in 92. And during that period, I was involved in opening the Ireland Fund in Ottawa and Montreal and Calgary and Hamilton. And I spent so much time doing it that I nearly, lost my business and got myself into financial difficulty. So I sort of took a bit of a sabbatical for 3 or 4 years. And then I rejoined the Ireland Fund when my friend at that time, Bill Neal, became chairman, and I thought it would be good to have a relationship with a man from Belfast and, my own background from Dublin and, my own experience of working with the Ireland Fund. So I did that until really 1997. I decided that, a really important development was understanding the famine. And I'd had the great pleasure and honor of meeting Norma Smurfit, when I was vice chair of the Ireland Fund in 1987 at a conference in Killarney. And she had commissioned Rowan Gillespie. She introduced me to Rowan Gillespie in 1993-94. And so Rowan and I became very good friends, and we still are. And so Norma then commissioned him to create the sculptures that are on the waterfront in Dublin. He'd actually created 2 or 3 figures first, and then Norma asked him to create additional figures, and they became the departure figures for the famine on Dublin's waterfront. So when the 1997 150th anniversary came around, I thought I would pursue discussions with City Councillor, at that time Olivia Chow, now the Mayor of Toronto, to secure a waterfront location, which I managed to do at the July-August sitting of council of 2020. So it was a loose group of volunteers between 97. And then when we knew we were getting the site for Ireland Park, the foundation was incorporated May 20th of 2000. And John Masterson, who was involved with Action Grow Seal, took part in that. And Bill Neal was also involved. We had to have 3 directors signing the Articles of Incorporation. But we already knew where the site was going to be. We had the land. I'd spent 3 years negotiating with the city for that. And Rowan had committed to create the sculptures, and my brother Jonathan had committed to design the park. So it was we were off and running. But there was a problem insofar as the Bathurst Quay was at that time optioned by a man called John Harris. And he was promoting his idea of Canada's metronome to create a destination for Canadian music on Toronto's waterfront. So it took some time for that to unravel. But eventually it did. And so then the campaign to raise money to build Ireland Park was set in motion on the 21st of June, 2004. And Rowan unveiled the first of his 5 sculptures, or a version of it, on June 21st. And he had actually poured the sculpture on the 11th, on September 11th. And he said, you know, it's very poignant for him to see the sculpture standing against the backdrop of Toronto's skyline. Because he said that when I began pouring the bronze, you can't take a break when you're pouring bronze at 1400 or 1500 degrees. So he said, by the time I finished pouring the bronze, the second airplane hit the other building in the World Trade Center. So the difference between the Toronto sculptures and Dublin, when Rowan started creating the sculptures in Dublin, he didn't know where they were going to go. And then subsequently, when Norma asked him to increase the number of sculptures from 3 or 4 up to 7, plus the dog, and then they went looking for a location, and then they found the location on Dublin's waterfront. Whereas when he started work for the sculptures in Dublin, he came to the site for Ireland Park at the end of August, and he'd been down in Arizona, and so he got up at 4 in the morning and went down to watch the sunrise over the east end of the city. And so his inclination was to raise his hands in the air, which is what we see with the first sculpture. And so I think, artistically, I think his sculptures for Toronto are somewhat better resolved, because he knew that they were going to stand together. He knew they were going to be on the waterfront. He knew they were going to be facing to the east, to the sunrise, the new day, and the future of Canada that they were going to contribute to. So it's quite poignant, and they do represent arrival, and whereas the sculptures in Dublin depict departure. But, you know, I would say, Austin, that a lot of people were involved in making that a possibility. And simultaneously, I was involved with fundraising for the Campaign for Celtic Studies. So I got to know, well, I'd known Anne Dooley for a long time, but I got to know David Wilson, Professor David Wilson, and Mark McGowan. So at the outset, I asked Mark to initiate some research into the story of what was going on in Toronto in 1847, because I wanted to make sure that whatever we said to our donors and friends and supporters and to the media was accurate and was rooted in veracity and from original sources. So that meant going to newspaper archives, it meant going to cemetery records at St. James Cathedral and the Catholic Archdiocese. And from that, then we pieced together what happened. And it became very evident it was an extraordinary story. And that's where we became aware of Dr. George Robert Grisset. So Dr. Grisset, his family had studied medicine in the Westmoreland Hospital in Dublin from the early years of the 18th century. His father was born in Barbados, and I'm going down to Barbados at the end of March to see the site of their family home in Barbados, which is called Grisette's to this day. And but George was born in Lisbon in 1811, and his older brother James was born in Gibraltar in 1808. So his younger brother, Robert, went down to Barbados and died there within a year of malaria. I mean, the Caribbean at that time was a pretty dangerous place because of malaria and other infectious diseases. And both French and British Army casualties were far greater from malaria and other warm weather-related diseases than combat. So so the Grisset family and the sacrifice of George Robert, a young 36-year-old doctor who lobbied his brother to become the medical officer, the attending surgeon in the emigrant hospital, I thought was an incredibly poignant story. And so it's one thing to create a place to commemorate famine migrants who survived the voyage on the North Atlantic, made landfall in Toronto, came down through the St. Lawrence, you know, through Kingston and onwards then to Toronto, and then to be met by Anglican doctors and nurses and hospital orderlies, as well as Bishop Parr and some of the nuns from Rathfarnham. But, you know, he was dead by the 16th of July, less than 30 days after being appointed, and totally forgotten. So I felt that we must complete the story of the 1847 migration by creating a park to honor his memory. And quite by chance, Adam Vaughan, who succeeded Olivia Chow as city councillor. Adam, you know, he and I became great pals. He described himself as a two-boater. His family were, his great-great-great-great-grandfather was deported to Australia for stealing horses, but he stole them from the British Army. That was considered a very, very bad thing to do. So his family subsequently left Australia, his branch, and came to Toronto. So Adam is a scholarly man when it comes to the, you know, the story of his family's presence in Canada. And he liked the concept of commemorating both the first great migrant wave to come to Toronto, you know, in the worst of possible circumstances, vast numbers, with an incurable, highly contagious disease, and the story of local Canadians stepping forward to help them, notwithstanding the risks to themselves. And we've learned along the way that it's very likely that George Robert Crousett wasn't paid. And so, you know, it's one thing to step forward to help people who subscribe to a religion that you don't subscribe to, in a city that, you know, regarded your religious views, you know, very seriously. And he stepped across that sectarian divide to help these people. I thought it was an act of extraordinary courage and valor. And I think it's part of the DNA of Canada and of this city to help other people. And I really related to that story. I thought this is a fine thing that happened in our city, and it should be celebrated. So Ireland Park, you know, was opened by President McAleese on the 21st of June of 07. And then after we regained our balance after the effort to raise that money, I said, let's do Grosset Park. And Adam was able to make available that single building lot at the corner of Adelaide and Whitmer Street, which was actually on the site of one of the fever sheds in 1847. So that's how Grosset occurred. So in 1998-99, during discussions with Olivia Chow, I said, you know, Olivia, I will be coming back some years from now to get that building, because, you know, John Harris is not going to prosper with his ambition for a music academy here. And that building would be an ideal visitor center, arts destination to celebrate the Irish contribution to this city and to Canada. So I put down the marker early, and then I kept badgering Adam Vaughan and Joe Cressy and Councillor Sita Ram Kalawan Singh, who was there on a temporary interim basis, and Joe Mahevic, anyone who occupied the council position for Trinity Spadina. You know, I was, you know, hammering on about the executive office building. So, you know, we persevered, and the efforts of a fantastic board and many, many, many generous individuals in the Toronto Irish community and the Government of Ireland, the Government of Canada, City of Toronto, made it possible for us to raise the $16 million after we acquired the building. And we hope to see it opened in March of next year, which is now, thanks to James Maloney, Irish Heritage Month in Canada. So in looking at this whole journey, Austin, I felt, okay, look, I've been doing this now basically for 45 years, and 27, 28 years with Canada Ireland Foundation and other things. And I don't want young people coming to Toronto to think, oh, there's no point getting involved with Canada Ireland Foundation. That's Kearns' deal. He's never gone anywhere except in a box. Well, that's not the case at all. Like, I really want young people and anyone else in the community who's interested to step forward and volunteer for the work of the foundation and any other Irish community organization they feel inclined to. I've just been there for too long. And I wanted to leave so that my successor, in this case, joyfully Mark Purdy, you know, could have the honor of presiding over the foundation for the opening of the building as part of his transition and, you know, continued elevation for the foundation. That, you know, that would be something I would like to hand off with a warm hand to him, say, look, you know, cross the finishing line and open this building. And I felt that was the way I wanted to do it. And so I'm very, very happy that Mark is the next chair. He was unanimously elected by everyone on the board, which is fantastic. And, I mean, Mark and I go back to the early 1990s because he served on the board of the Ireland Fund. He was chair of the lunch for 3 years. He did fantastic work for the Ireland Fund of Canada. And, of course, the Ireland Fund gave us our first major gift of $250,000, which we've never forgotten and always want to celebrate, back in 2004. And so that later became $500,000 in response to the Government of Canada, and then the Government of Ireland matched that. So, you know, one good deed triggered a lot of other ones. So Mark has been involved with Canada-Ireland Foundation since at least the early 2000s. And so he has served the board with generosity, with engagement, and I can't think of anyone on our board who is better qualified in terms of his continuous involvement with the foundation and his commitment to the ideals of the foundation, which is to celebrate both in the arts and in history and in music and literature the contribution that people from the island of Ireland have made to Canada.
Robert, two things. One, you mentioned that you were, when the Ireland Fund was being established and you traveled across the country, to the extent that you had to pull back, that your business was potentially at risk. And secondly, then, given the amount of, over the 45 years, as you've described it, an awful lot of immigrants, when we arrive, there's a period where we're so consumed with just having to get settled and rear our families that we pull back as well. And that the time isn't there. And I know one of the great regret things I had to give up when I came was I think I played my last rugby game a week or two before I emigrated, and that was the last game of rugby I played. I had to give it up, but just couldn't do it. Were there times, or was there a period where you felt, I just can't keep doing this, I have to, it's not happening fast enough, or I need to pull back and devote more, just I'm going nowhere?
Oh yeah, well, you know, very much so. Certainly in 1991-92, when the economic crisis hit and the property values in Toronto dropped by 40%, that had economic consequences for me, and very significant economic consequences for me. And so I really had less involvement with my volunteer life between, say, late 1992 and 1997. But, you know, I when I say I'm going to do something, I'm pretty passionate about it. Now, I was not successful in my marriages, and I've never had children. So I've filled up a lot of that space and time with my volunteer work. And I don't know whether that's a good thing or not. I don't know. But that's what I did, and that's been my journey. And you know, I just thought there's things that I'd love to see happen. I wanted to see the park built. I wanted it to be long-term when the grain silos were conserved and the dock walls were done, because no sooner was the park finished than the dock walls were in very precarious condition. So I immediately delved into lobbying the federal government and the city of Toronto to restore the dock walls, because, you know, there are four boundaries to the park, and there was just never a time when one could just open Ireland Park and buzz off. Like, you couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. It's like you lit this big, you know, beacon bonfire on the waterfront, and all four corners were at risk. So the city of Toronto spent $10 million building a new dock wall along the east side of Bathurst Quay, which is now Erin Quay. And then I spent a lot of time going up and down to Queen's Park and to the city of Toronto, trying to find $8-9 million to do the dock wall along the south side. And then there was the grain silos that were shedding and spoiling concrete, which resulted in, you know, a rather unattractive chain link fence going around the base of the silos, because concrete was falling off. And one lump of concrete fell off the grain silos and smashed one of the wooden benches in half. Now, if you'd been sitting there, you'd be deceased. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the city were in their rights to fence off the grain silos till that was done. And then to the west, where the building is, there were all kinds of gougers who wanted to knock down the building and throw up condos. So it was on the battlements 24/7 from the opening of the park in 07 to get the dock walls done, to get the grain silos conserved, and then to get the building. So I regarded it as one point of the compass at a time. So we got the east side done, and then we got the west-south side done, and then the grain silos, and then the building. So, you know, my board are sick and tired of me talking about taking the long view, but you really do have to take the mm-hmm. long view. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, everyone on our board, you know, I always told them, if you're going to join the board, don't think about, you know, coming here and, you know, and doing something for 6 months and then buzzing off. Like, this is, you're a lifer. You might get parole after 3 or 6 years, but it's, you have to take it seriously. And so certainly Mark, I do know, has, because of the 25 years he's been involved with the foundation, I know he will hand off in a similar way at the right time. It'll be a new board at that time, but I know he will follow in a manner that's suitable for the foundation at that time. Because, you know, we all want to see the foundation here 5 and 10 years from now, 25 years and 50 and 100 years from now. So I'm very, very strong about archives, about photographs, about keeping records, because that's part of our journey as a community.
Robert, it is consequently not surprising that in 2016 you did receive the Irish Presidential Distinguished Service Award, and that you were honoured in 2021 Governor General's of Ontario Heritage Award and Lifetime Achievement. Well deserved, and I know you're currently serving on the board of the NATO Association of Canada, and you were 9 years a member of the board of Roy Thompson. Robert, we could talk for hours, but we won't. Thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for all you've done for the Irish in Toronto and in Canada, and for the Irish back in Ireland, because of things like the sculptors, particularly, that there is that connection that has raised awareness in Ireland of the Canadian relationship, which was many times forgotten. And you have done huge work in helping generate an interest and keeping it alive, the Irish contribution to Canada and the Canadian importance to Ireland. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Austin. I think it's going to be increasingly relevant in the weeks and months to come. Canada will be seen more clearly from the Irish perspective. And similarly, like tomorrow, the Prime Minister is having a unity meeting of premiers and business leaders on diversifying our economy. And that natural diversity with the Irish economy and Canada, you know, will be very successful.
Thank you, Robert.